Our second speaker is Dr. Turner. As you all know, she is the Director of Member Services for the American College of Surgeons. She's a Clinical Associate Professor of Surgery at the University of Chicago. She is a past president of the Society of Black Academic Surgeons, as well as our chair of our ACS delegation to the AMA House of Delegates. She has literally transformed the member experience at the College of Surgeons, and we are very fortunate to be beneficiaries of her leadership and advocacy on our behalf.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you so much for the kind invitation to spend some time with you this morning. I really appreciate the opportunity to share some thoughts. For those of you in the room, there really are some seats up here in the front. Like, it's okay, you can come forward. And so this really will follow on a lot of what Dr. Spain said. You know, his talk was great. I took a couple of pictures myself. And so I would really encourage you to take notes and listen to what he said about being promoted in academic surgery. A lot of what I say is going to really interdigitate with some of what he described, and you'll hear some common themes. I'm going to take issue with the don't be on the committees, because of course I'm going to go tell you to be on ACS committees. That said, there's a lot of commonality in what we're going to talk about. So how to reach and maintain leadership status in the AMA, ACS. God. ACS. So I have no disclosures. So leadership, you know, we all have read about it. We all have books on our bookshelves. So there's 1,000 definitions. These are some that I like, and I think it's instructive to start on the process whereby an individual influences a group of individuals to attain a common goal. Importantly, contemporary leadership is not tied to a position or a title. Like, the days of you having leadership and having everyone respect you by virtue of the seat you're sitting in, those days are pretty much gone. You have to be an effective leader in your own right, and it's not just your position, or it's not just the title, or if that does last for a short time, it doesn't last long. It's not sustainable. And everyone has the potential to lead. So the young surgeons in the room, the older surgeons in the room, the residents in the room. So we all have a potential to lead. So really our goal is to leverage our skill sets to be an effective leader wherever you are at that point in your career. So interestingly, creativity is a number one desirable attribute for leaders, according to this IBM Global CEO study. It's a couple years old, but honestly, I've been reading more of the business literature, and I'll tell you that things like this continue to be in the literature. So it's not to say that you don't need to be a content expert, because of course you do. But frankly, being a content expert is the floor, not the ceiling. Like, it is expected that you're a content expert, and then there's these other things on top of that that help you be an effective leader. So creativity is one of the things that is really sought after. So what are some derailing behaviors? You know, you hate to lead with a negative, which is why I made it the third slide, not the second. But here are some things that will trip you up. And I think it's important to spend just a couple of minutes thinking about them. So if you are supposed to be a leader, but yet you lack enthusiasm or energy, you're trying to lead a team and you're like lazy, that'll cut you off at the knees every time. What if you're kind of mediocre and you're trying to, you know, crack the whip on everybody else, but you really are not embodying that hustle that you want from your team? That's really, that's a problem. Not having clear vision and direction. There are as many different ways to lead as there are individuals, and there's lots of books that go through the different, you know, the democratic style and the autocratic style and the affiliative style. So there's a lot of different ways to lead, but you have to be able to articulate your vision. You don't necessarily need to be a soaring orator, but you have to be able to articulate your vision to lead a team or to be an effective member of a team. If you have poor judgment, I mean, clearly we're surgeons. We hope that that applies to no one in the room. If you don't collaborate, and sometimes that doesn't come naturally to us as surgeons. You know, we're used to being the captain of the ship, or, you know, whatever the metaphor is you like to use, and certainly in your OR, you are that person. But in other contexts, if you can't gather the insights of those around you and those teammates, then you're going to be a less effective leader. So important to know how to collaborate, and that really speaks to some of the emotional intelligence that you heard about in Dr. Spain's talk. If you're inauthentic, people can tell. If you're a liar, or if you're just trying to get somebody to do something because, you know, you've got a sort of Machiavellian backstory, people will figure you out, and it might take them a little while, but you can't recover from dishonesty. So don't let that happen to you. Being resistant to new ideas, really, again, we're surgeons, we're innovators, so typically new ideas come pretty easily to us, but sometimes we get kind of entrenched. Or if you don't learn from your mistakes, lacking interpersonal skills really ties into the emotional intelligence piece. failing to develop others. And I really emphasize that one because part of being an effective leader or an effective teammate is advocating for those around you. Because if it's all about you, much like the inauthenticity piece, then you're really not a good team member. So a lot of being an effective team member, being on a committee, being a leader is developing those around you, advocating for those around you, being a sponsor, and being positive for your team. And then obviously, if you're an ineffective communicator, that is a significant problem. Going back to being able to articulate your vision and direction. So these are key things. We all have strengths in some of these areas and weaknesses in others. So what you want to remember is shoring up these skill sets can help you downstream. So this is a book that I thought was pretty interesting, Teaching Smart People How to Learn. So Harvard Business Review, it's a classic, it's not new, but there's a lot to read here. So if you want to read it, go ahead and do that. But one of the interesting things that I think is relevant for this highly accomplished room is that there's some difficulty sometimes in teaching smart people how to learn because you're so good at everything, you've always been at the top of your class, you're always an expert at everything. And so the author talks about this notion of privilege and that if you are always the best in your class and you're always getting A's and you've never struggled, that you sometimes have a difficult time being innovative because you don't want to step outside your comfort zone because you don't want to ever be wrong or you don't want to ever fail. And again, I think that ties into some of what we heard before. So it's important to be introspective. That's really the take-home message from this, that you will fail. You will have things that you don't do well. You are not going to be the expert in every single thing that you do, but that's okay. Like if you were the expert in everything, then you would have nowhere to go. But innovation and being someone who is an effective leader in an organization or in an institution or in a department requires accelerating the failure cycle because you've got to reach a little bit outside your comfort zone. So this is a little bit of a different way of looking at it and something that I found particularly meaningful and I try to remember. So I'm not going to spend too much time on this except to say if you're going to be a leader, if you're going to be on a committee, if you're going to lead an organization, a department, a division, an institution, then you've got to talk about change management because part of the whole principle is changing people from the way they're doing things over here to what you perceive to be the better way to do it over there. So this notion of change leadership, that equation there on the left is that effectiveness is of an outcome equals the quality of the solution times the acceptance, the accountability, and the alignment of the solution. So if you come up with a solution that's not aligned with the institution or aligned with the society, then you may not be as successful. If you don't think through all the possibilities, if you don't articulate it clearly, if you don't get buy-in from others, then it may be the best solution in the world and doesn't actually change anyone's behavior. So I won't spend a lot of time on that, but that's part of having a conversation about how to be an influential leader in any organization, not just the college. And then again, the whole notion of emotional intelligence, which you've already heard about, but is important, you have to manage yourself before you can manage other people. So if you get tachycardic and angry when a certain person walks into your office or walks into that committee meeting, you're never going to be able to be fully effective as a leader in that organization or on that committee. So you have to manage yourself before you can manage outward. And then the last sort of leadership statement I'll make is that, innovation, again, this is the American College of Surgeons. We want innovators. We want creative thinkers. We want people to solve problems in new ways. We want you to bring your new ideas to bear on our committees and our councils and so on and so forth. So knowing what is new, knowing whether, we can actually do that, knowing if we can implement that is part of being an effective member. So this quote, I know many of you have heard from Dr. Altman. In the past, we didn't include physicians and surgeons in discussions about how to fix the American healthcare system because we thought they were part of the problem, and that was a big mistake. We need them as part of the solution because they are American healthcare. So this is relevant in an advocacy setting, which is where he said it, but it's also relevant overall about how the entire House of Surgery needs each of you and what you bring to the table. So this is my segue into the ACS and how it is that we, this particular book, Lessons Learned in Quality, in the Pursuit of Quality Surgical Healthcare, the ACS needs people who are experts in quality. We need people who are experts in advocacy. We need people who are fascinated by outcomes research. We need the hardcore, rat doctors, and we also need the people who maybe don't even operate on the rats at all, but are, you know, the amazing clinicians who are bringing something new to the table. So with 84,000 members, you know, we need some of everybody's expertise. So there is room for you to be involved in the work of the ACS. So what are some of the benefits of being engaged, you know, here at the college? So networking, clearly there is an element of this meeting that's fun, like networking, interacting with people who have common issues to you, both pro and con, and seeing people that you might be, you know, haven't seen since training or since medical school or since your first job or whatever. So there's a networking component. Clearly education is one of the hallmarks and one of the central parts of the meeting and of being a part of the organization. And so you may want to contribute in that way. You know, advocacy, we already talked about practice management and tips and tools, those skills that allow you to be an effective practice management surgeon. Those are important. Some of us are employed, some of us are not employed. So there is an element of that, whether you're an academician or not, I will submit to you that you can no longer ignore the financial parts of being a surgeon. You know, even the academicians have to think about that. So clearly leadership and an opportunity to shape the field. Do you want to direct the way that surgery is going or the way that the college is going? And being a member, an active participant in the college is a way to do that. Clearly scientific inquiry and advancement, finding collaborators, finding out what's new on the cutting edge, being perhaps even a situation to find a research collaborator. And then as a stepping stone or pathway to other desired roles and responsibilities, you may want to be like Dr. Spain on the board. Well, you know, the ACS nominates people to the board. So that might be a pathway, you know, if education is your passion and you get from point A to point B, and you can be like Dr. Spain when you grow up. You know, improve patient care. Clearly, that's the key. You know, that's what all of this is about. So ultimately, all of us want to provide the best possible care for our patients. And so all of this comes together around providing the best possible patient care. And then spending time with other smart and interesting people. So networking, you know, kind of with the professional air quotes, and then just actually meeting people that are interesting or nice or that you'd like to keep in touch with or, you know, maybe even be friends with. So all of that is part of the organizational structure. So I'm going to put this diversity comment here because we are a room, you all are young surgeons. So there is this notion that organizations are only interested in people that are, you know, of a certain age or have been in practice for a certain number of decades, or, you know, the reality is that we are all benefited by having a diverse group of people at the table. And whether that means individuals that are coming from private practice and academics, whether it means people that are coming from rural and urban, whether it means the old and the young, whether it means the relatively new in practice, the long time in practice, I mean, there is a need for all of you at the table. So, you know, we know as an organization that we benefit from having individuals at the table, on our committees, on our councils, engaged in the leadership of the college, that bring a diverse skill set to the table in every possible iteration. I mean, it allows us to solve more complex problems. It allows us to reach better solutions to the problems that we have. It allows us to ask questions that we might not have asked had we not had the right people on the seats on the bus, as the metaphor goes. So know that this is a priority for us in the ACS. So this is just a screenshot of the of part of the ACS web page, and I put this up here so we could talk about some of the elements of the ways that you can get engaged. So I hope you can see it. I literally just took a screenshot. So up here you'll see that I'm logged in. So there's me, Patricia Turner. So all of you who are members have a user ID that you can log in and you can get to this, and we'll point things in your direction that are important for you. But, you know, in terms of organization of the college, I think it's worth spending a couple of minutes just because there's a lot going on at the college, and it's not always obvious to people what all the different elements are. So down on this left side, this is literally on the About ACS under governance. So for those of you that are like wonky and really want to read this, you can do this. But just running down the side here, there's the executive staff, there are committees, there's about 70 committees at the college, literally 70, maybe even 80. So whatever it is you're interested in, I guarantee you there is a committee of the college that has as at least part of its focus what it is that you're passionate about. And we are nearly always looking for additional people who are interested. There's a Board of Regents. So the Board of Regents is the metaphor that I'll use is it's kind of like the Senate, smaller in number, than the Board of Governors, which is larger in number, kind of like the House of Representatives. But they both are arms that help to guide the things that we do. So those are clearly leadership opportunities. Those are sort of the highest leadership opportunities at the college. But there are representatives from every specialty on both of those boards. So whatever your specialty may be, there are individuals, again, academicians as well as private practitioners in both of those on both of those boards. So there's an opportunity for engagement. There's 24 regions. There's 282 governors. The governors come from other countries. They come from chapters in the U.S. They come from specialty, subspecialty societies. So if you are a neurosurgeon and you do spine, there's a neurosurgery spine society, and they have a governor that has a seat, you know, in the ACS. So that's, those are two clear ways to get involved. The advisory councils here, we have 13 advisory councils actually now, as of this meeting, a newest 14th one, one for each specialty within surgery. So again, whether you're an ophthalmologist, an orthopedic surgeon, a general surgeon, there is a group that specifically has as its focus the clinical issues related to your specific specialty. So the ACS is, without exception, the house of surgery for all surgeons. Dropping down here a little bit more are the chapters. I think that's chapters I'm pointing to. So there are chapters both domestically and internationally. So again, if you don't want to, or you know, it's probably not reasonable to leap straight to the Board of Regents, but there is room in your local environment for you to be involved at the chapter level. And most of the chapters, perhaps not all, but most of the chapters have a designated slotted seat for the young, a young surgeon, like a YFA seat. So YFA here means those surgeons under the age of 45. I'm heartbroken actually that I'm no longer young, so I might like burst into tears here at the podium because it hurts my heart. But the young fellows under the age of 45 are YFA, and then the RAS is Resident and Associate Society. So that's those who are still in training, or those who have finished training but aren't yet ready to be a fellow. And that could be for a couple of reasons. One, you haven't passed your boards yet. Depending on your specialty, it may take, you know, some amount of time to pass your boards. Orthopedics, for example, you have to practice for a couple of years before you can sit for the second part of your boards. So you would be an associate in that time frame. Or maybe you don't take your boards your first year out, or you know, you did the writtens but you didn't do the orals or whatever. So that whole period of time where you're early career but not a fellow, you are by very definition a member of RAS, the Resident and Associate Society. Once you become a fellow, but under the age of 45, you are again by definition a member of the YFA or the Young Fellows Association. And then again, all of the committees. I can't talk about all of the committees, but again, this is just another screenshot. So I literally just went to member services, which happens to be my division. And here are some of the committees. I'll go through them, but we'll say as an aside, again, if you, just to frame it, there are five divisions of the college. So the Division of Member Services is the one that I have responsibility for, and we'll talk a little bit about some of our opportunities for engagement. There's a Division of Advocacy and Health Policy, which is run by our lobbyist, Christian Shalgin, based in DC. We have both federal advocacy, we have states advocacy, we have legislative affairs, we have general surgery coding and reimbursement. You know, how many people know what an RVU is? Raise your hand. Hi. Okay. All right. So there's a bunch of you whose hands didn't go up. So that's the way you get paid. And there are people who sit in hotel rooms, windowless dark rooms, who haggle about literally the number of dollars associated with each RVU, and it's a single pie. So every penny that we get paid as surgeons comes out of the mouths of somebody else. I mean, it's unfortunate that it's that sort of relationship, but that's the way the federal government works. So there are people on your behalf that are sitting in the room on behalf of the college and you as members negotiating literally for there to be more money in your paycheck by virtue of assigning a higher value to the relative value unit, which is what an RVU stands for the operations that you do. And so for every penny that we get, you know, there's less in the E&M pot for example, our primary care colleagues for whom we have great respect. But, you know, in this context, sadly, you know, it's a competition. So advocacy and health policy is all of that. Then there is the Division of Education. So the Division of Education obviously has significant purview over this entire Clinical Congress event, as well as surgeons as leaders, surgeons as teachers, the Academy of Master Surgeons that just was developed, the General Surgery Coding and Reimbursement course. There's a number of things that there's a residence as leaders course. So there's a lot that comes under the umbrella of of education, including things like CSAP, which many of us use to study for our boards. So that is an entire, and again, I'm not doing it justice because we just don't have the time, but that's the Division of Education. So there's a lot in there that might interest you. There's a Division of Research and Optimal Patient Care. So that's all of the QIPs, all the databases, TQIP, NISQIP, Bariatric QIP, which is MSVS QIP. The Strong for Surgery program, pediatric surgery quality. So all of our accreditation and verification projects. So if you go to a hospital or if you're at a hospital and you are engaged in the quality initiatives, whether that be trauma or cancer or whatever, all of that is under the Division of Research and Optimal Patient Care. So there's room for you if you're interested in outcomes research. There's room for you if you want to be the surgeon champion for NISQIP at your place. And if you have a specific interest in those specific clinical areas, then again, research and optimal patient care is a place which you can in which you can get engaged. The Division of Integrated Communications manages our journal. So many of you read JAX. It manages the website. It manages the communities. It manages the bulletin, which many of us read voraciously from beginning to end. So there's a lot involved in the whole way in which we communicate with our members that belongs in the Division of Integrated Communications. And then in member services, again, just to highlight a couple of committees, just because there's this level of depth or more depth in every pillar of the college. For example, this well-being index, you know, we're interested in the whole notion of wellness and burnout, and this is an assessment tool, and there's an entire program that will come to bear around the things that we can do that address the environment factors that lead to us being less satisfied, as well as the things that we can do for individual surgeons to help facilitate that. Intimate partner violence, there is an initiative that I'm privileged to co-lead with Dr. Barbara Bass. So you'll notice there's some purple ribbons going around. So this notion of intimate partner violence is something that affects the surgeon community as well. So that impacts our members, therefore it's a priority for us. Scholarships and fellowships. So we give out about $2 million a year, $2.1 million actually, in scholarships and fellowships. So some international, some domestic, some for rural people, some for people who have an NIH grant and want to supplement to their R01. I mean, so there's a lot of scholarship money that we give out. But again, you've got to be engaged. You have to know that exists. And there's application processes around that, and we can talk about it offline. Again, the chapters we talked about, an easy way to get involved. So many of them have resident programs. Many of them have medical students engaged. So we have an opportunity for involvement there, and you can take on a leadership role. I'll say parenthetically for the young people in the room who haven't done this is that if you go volunteer for something, I guarantee you'll have a task by the end of the meeting. Like, no one is looking to exclude you from anything. So if you want to be involved, put your hand up and say, I want to be involved, and it will happen. Medical students, we kind of talked about already. Again, I won't belabor all of this because there's just not enough time. Operation Giving Back, our humanitarian outreach effort, there's three or four committees under Operation Giving Back. So even outside the clinical practice of surgery, if you're interested in global outreach, there's a way for you to get involved around that. And anyway, let me just keep going here. So what are some recommendations? Be timely. Often the way to get a leadership role is that someone will ask you to do something that's relatively mundane, and if you do a good job, the next thing you know, they're coming back to you to ask you to do something else. Being timely is really important, because if you're late with the mundane, they will assume that you will be late with the more important things, and you'll never get assigned other things. And it's not to say that you can't make a mistake and recover from it, but if you sadly get a reputation of being someone who can't turn things in on time, like you're sort of... You'll move off the trajectory, and you just don't want that to happen. It seems like something that I don't have to say, but believe me when I say I've seen people torpedoed because they can't get their stuff in on time. So don't let that be you. Complete assignments well and pay attention to the details. So again, having something that's elegant and you clearly spent a lot of time working on it and it looks nice, your PowerPoint doesn't have whatever typos in it or whatever, the attention to detail is important. We're surgeons, we look for we aren't nitpicking, like looking for problems, but we notice if something is done really well. So let that be your calling card, that someone would say if they saw something that was sloppy, that they'd be like, yeah, that couldn't have been Dr. Whomever, because they just would never turn in work like that. So pay attention. Try to accept new responsibilities. Again, this is where I'm going to differ a little bit from Dr. Spain. I totally agree with him. I was a program director, you know, so I get it. Like, I remember trying to mentor junior faculty. So yeah, agreed. You can't overextend. But to the extent that you can take something else on your plate, or to the extent that you can take something else on your plate and offload another thing, try to accept new responsibilities, because you often don't know what's going to lead to some really meaningful next step. So you have to know yourself. This is where the introspection comes in. This is where the emotional intelligence comes in, what you can and can't do well. Better to say no than to do it and do it poorly. But to the extent that you can accept a new responsibility, try to do that, particularly if it comes to you from someone who you know to have your best interests at heart. So those sponsors and mentors, so J. David Richardson is certainly one of mine. L.D. Britt is another. I wouldn't make a decision without calling Dr. Britt. You know, I'm a pretty grown person. But when it comes to decisions about careers in surgery, like, you will have a stable of people that you'll call on. And so if one of those people asks you to take on something, you really need to think long and hard about whether you're going to say no, because they clearly want the best for you, and they wouldn't have asked you if they didn't think it was important. But be mindful of that. Try to view every opportunity as a stepping stone. So again, it may just be being a member of a committee, but that's how you get to be the chair of the committee. I think sometimes we want to step into responsibilities at the top, and that's not typically how it works. So you may have to do a little bit of the grunt work. It's like a residency, right? You know, you may have to be just a member of the committee before you get tapped to be its chair. Go to the meetings. And I say this not in a self-serving way, because we're standing here at the ACS Clinical Congress, but go to the meetings, because if no one knows you, it's really hard to move up in the ranks. It's hard to get promoted. If you're an academician and you're trying to get from assistant to associate and nobody knows you outside of your institution, probably not going to get promoted, or it's going to be hard, because you have to demonstrate some sort of national recognition. If you never go to the meetings and nobody knows who you are, then who's going to write your external letters for you? Like, we could give an entire talk on promotion and tenure. We don't have time. But you've got to get to the meetings. You've got to get out there. You've got to go up to the microphone. Hi, my name is Patricia Turner from Chicago. This is my question about this amazing thing you just presented. My research, you know, coalesces with yours. I mean, that's how people get to know you. And then they'll grab you at the coffee break, and they'll say, oh, let's talk. And then the next thing you know, they're asking you to be on a panel at the meeting in a year. And then, you know, your career takes off from there. So you have to be present. You have to go to the meetings. You have to not be scared to say something. I think that's actually one of my points later on. To speak up. Be expert at something. Like, be the world's expert at something. And allow that to be your calling card. You're not going to be the world's expert at everything, but whatever it is, you know, as Dr. Spain says, that inflames your passions, like, let it inflame your passions and be the world's expert. So when people are sitting in a room, as we do, trying to come up with people to give a talk on X or comment on Y, that yours is a name that springs to mind in a knee-jerk sort of way. Volunteer if no one asks you. Again, we're always looking for people to do things. So if you volunteer, I guarantee I'm going to give you the job just because, like, somebody's got to do it and, like, I've had enough on my plate. But volunteer if no one asks you, and you'd be surprised how well received that is. And be comfortable interacting with important people. You know, sometimes I think our young surgeons are so worried about not talking to Dr. X or Dr. Y, whose name might be on the binder of the textbook, that they undermine their own opportunities. So go up to them, talk to them. They drink coffee like everybody else. You know, that's why we have coffee breaks at every meeting. Go to, you know, events like the Taste of the City, where people are mingling around, and walk up to somebody and talk to them, because they're typically, not always, but typically more approachable than you think. And avoid defensiveness in response to feedback. That really speaks to the emotional intelligence piece again. If you get feedback, even if it's difficult to hear, much like the story you told, you know, sometimes people are just being dreadful human beings, but not typically. Like, usually there's some kernel of truth in there, and whether you want to hear it or not, what you probably need to do is go sit with that information and then process what kernel of truth there is that you can apply to yourself. And certainly, you know, many of us, myself included, have a tendency to be defensive because you're trying to do your best. But if you can just, again, I'm speaking for myself, if I can just listen to what was said and sit with it for a minute, I often can find that there's something in there that's meaningful. So what's my commitment? So I commit that, to the extent that I have anything to do with it, at the ACS at least, you know, we'll have an open and transparent succession planning and nominating process. You know, sometimes things are really smoke and mirrors, and it all happens in the back room, and I can't say that I'm going to be able to pull the curtain back on every single thing, but to the extent possible, you know, we'll have an open process so you can see how to get from point A to point B. It may take you a decade to get there if where you want to be is, you know, on the board of whatever, but if there's a process that you understand, then, you know, it's easier to get there and to do that succession planning. To have an inclusive effort when appointing committees, naming moderators, convening work groups, to try not to just always go to the knee-jerk people, but think about and ask around who else might be a good person whose name might not be at the top of our list, but who might be a great person to have that exposure. To develop mentorship or advocate relationships, either formally or informally. We do a lot of that in member services. Certainly the YFA has led the charge on mentoring relationships in many regards. You know, Dr. Sachdeva's team in education does that. But certainly those mentor and advocate and sponsor sort of relationships are what allows person, more senior person, to put the name of more junior person into the conversation when we're looking for someone to be a leader. Incorporate more junior or early career members into these feeder positions that lead to the other positions. Actively engage our senior leaders to ask them who they know, because a lot of them know a lot of people. And then to use a body of literature from the business world to highlight these elements that we talked about of inclusivity, creativity, so that we aren't always looking for someone cut from the exact same mold when time comes to name them to leadership positions. So with that, I'll stop. I don't think we have questions, time for questions, but that's my contact information. So you can email me, you can call me, you can PM me on Twitter. And I am pretty timely about responding. So thank you all for your attention. Thank you for the privilege of the podium.